Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. For more than 40 years, artist Sally Mann has made experimental, elegiac, and hauntingly beautiful photographs that are all bred of a place, the American South. Using her deep love of her native land and her knowledge of its fraught history, Mann asks provocative questions about history, identity, race, and religion that reverberate across geographic and national boundaries. On view from March 4th through May 28th, 2018, Sally Mann, A Thousand Crossings, considers how Mann's relationship with this land has shaped her work and how the legacy of the South, as both homeland and graveyard, refuge and battleground, continues to permeate American identity. On May 20th, 2018, in conjunction with the exhibition, artists Janine Michener-Bales and Clarissa Sly share their processes of reimagining and representing histories of African Americans. This program is made possible by the James D. and Catherine K. Steele Fund for Photography.
So this project basically took me 14 years to complete. I did have, at the time when I started it, a job in advertising, like Sarah had mentioned, my degree. And I guess I was researching on the side, and kind of it was before the Freedom Trail initiatives, and so a lot of the information was very difficult to find. So I was lucky enough to kind of stumble on a treasure trove at the Indiana Historical Society, where there was one librarian who had been working there for years and years and years. And anytime she came across any information on the Underground Railroad, whether it was a newspaper clipping from the time period or something more recent, she would make a photocopy of it and stick it into this clippings file folder. And so when I stumbled on that, I was extremely excited to find some of the information. So I have, a lot of quotes from the participants, because all of the people that were part of this journey have all passed away. And so I wanted to bring their voices and their thoughts into the project. And so you'll see throughout the book and the, the slides, different quotes from people. So this is actually from Frederick Douglass, and he's trying to give us a sense of what slavery would have been like. And he states that he could think, no better exposure of slavery can be made than is made by the laws of the states in which slavery exists. If more than 7 slaves together are found in any road without a white person, 20 lashes apiece. For visiting a plantation without a pass, 10 lashes. For letting loose a boat from where it is made fast, 39 lashes for the first offense, and for the second shall have cut off from his head 1 ear. For keeping or carrying a club, 39 lashes. For having any article for sale without a ticket from his master, 10 lashes. For traveling in any other than the most usual and accustomed road when going alone to any place, 40 lashes. For traveling in the night without a pass, 40 lashes. He further states, I'm afraid you do not understand the awful character of these lashes. You must bring it before your mind. A human being in a perfect state of nudity, tied hand and foot to a stake, and a strong man standing behind with a heavy whip knotted at the end, each blow cutting into the flesh and leaving the warm blood dripping to the feet. And for these trifles, for being found in another person's quarters, 40 lashes. For hunting with dogs in the woods, 30 lashes. For being on horseback without the written permission of his master, 25 lashes. For riding or going abroad in the night or riding horses in the daytime without leave, a slave may be whipped, cropped, or branded in the cheek with the letter R, or otherwise punished, such punishment not extending to life, or so as to render him unfit for labor. All of these laws referred to, you can still find in writing, coming from Brevard's Digest, Hayward's Manual, Virginia Revised Code, Prince's Digest, Missouri Laws, and the Mississippi Revised Code. I wanted to go over some of the research that I did. Basically, the entire project was informed by the research. Like I said, spent a long time on it, and that kind of gave me the framework of the series, and so it informed the title as well. So I found that fugitives would travel roughly 20 miles per night. So these are some of the maps that I was consulting to try to figure out stations that existed, and then also try to figure out what stations were nearby that they could have gone through within that amount of, distance. I read many, many, many first-person narratives. The WPA in the 1930s actually went back and interviewed former slaves, and they put out these books. And they divided them by states from where they were living. And so also consulted many other books in different historical societies and other such sources. And it was very heavy reading to do. Oftentimes I would have to put it down and go play with my dog or hang out with my son just to get the images that I had been reading about out of my head. This is kind of maybe, I don't know, an eighth or a 16th of the library that I built up while I was doing all the research. So I would take some of those clipping files that I mentioned and put them into binders. And so I have little stickies kind of referencing where they were and if they were irrelevant along the path. And some of them are pulled from master's theses. I'm getting them from writing different historians and asking if they can share some of their research. It was a logistical puzzle to put together. I did consult a lot of, period sources. So on the left is a handwritten minutes page from the Neils Creek Anti-Slavery Society, and they were in southern Indiana. And basically, the Constitution is what you're seeing up there, and it is their goal was to be the total abolition of slavery. On the right is actually, it's a pledge from Jay Pierce. And so at the time, it was illegal to help people escape slavery. And he was proclaiming publicly by signing this pledge. He signed his name to it. And then he wrote out that he was going to help. And then on the back, also above his name, you'll notice that there's a cipher there. So they were actually encoding messages. This is the Free Labor Advocate and Slavery Chronicle. So there was an area in Indiana, kind of on the Ohio border, and it was a Quaker stronghold, and a lot of the people that had decided to live there had moved from Tennessee and North Carolina. So they had witnessed the atrocities of slavery firsthand. So they were adamantly opposed to it. And what you're seeing are some ads that are in that newspaper, and they're actually free labor goods stores. So they were purchasing produce, cotton, and other things that were not made with slave labor. This is the documented route that I settled on to photograph. It was changing constantly as I was going through the process trying to find locations. Did the Underground Railroad exist in the South? Not so much. So I kind of pieced together a route that I thought somebody could have possibly taken in the South using those first-person narratives about where they would have stopped. I did find that people would run away in protest just for a day or a week or something and go to a neighboring plantation and then return back. So I figured that they would adopt that philosophy if they were running permanently. So it goes from Louisiana up through, across Louisiana, up through Mississippi, the corner of Alabama. Then you're in Kentucky or Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, Michigan, and finally ending in Sarnia, Ontario. Detroit was actually dubbed Midnight, so slave catchers, if they didn't catch anybody within the first couple hundred miles, they would just go to Detroit and wait. I can't imagine getting that far and getting caught in the end. This is the first image in the series, and it's entitled Decision to Leave, Magnolia Plantation on the Cane River in Louisiana, and it was taken in 2013. Frederick Douglass states, "No man can tell the intense agony which was felt by the slave when wavering on the point of making his escape. All that he has is at stake, and even that which he has not is at stake also. The life which he has may be lost, and the liberty which he seeks may not be granted." Southern Pine Forest, following El Camino Real, LaSalle Parish, Louisiana, 2014. Stopover, Frogmore Plantation, Concordia Parish, Louisiana, 2014. John Little, who is a former slave, says, "'Tisn't he who has stood and looked on that can tell you what slavery is. Tis he who has endured." Moonlight Over the Mississippi, Tensas Parish, Louisiana, 2014. And Frederick Douglass again states, "'Brothers and sisters we were by blood, but slavery had made us strangers. I heard the words brother and sister and knew they must mean something, but slavery robbed these terms of their true meaning.'" On the left is Sunken Trace, Claiborne County, Mississippi, 2015. And on the right, Determining True North in the Rain along the southern part of the Old Natchez Trace, Mississippi, 2014. And this is the account of the escape of Reverend Jacob Cummings. A local grocer heard that the Smiths were mistreating their slaves. He showed Cummings a map of Lake Erie, spoke with him about Ohio and Indiana, taught him to find the North Star and determine direction by moss on the tree, and encouraged him to make a run for it. In July 1839, Cummings fled, and he was successful. Cypress Swamp, Middle Mississippi, 2014. The Censor, which is an anti-slavery weekly, and this is from February 26, 1868. The conveyance most used on the southern section is known as the Foot and Walker Line, the passengers running their own trains, steering by the North Star, and swimming rivers when no boat could be borrowed. Keep Going, Crossing the Tennessee River, Colbert County, Alabama, 2014. Frederick Douglass says, "A keen observer might have detected in our repeated singing of O Canaan, sweet Canaan, I am bound for the land of Canaan, something more than a hope of reaching heaven. We meant to reach the north, and the north was our Canaan." Devil's Backbone, Lewis County, Tennessee, 2014. William, who is a slave and also a half-brother to a United States senator, says, "The man I called master was my half-brother. My mother was a better woman than his, and I was the smartest boy of the two. But while he had a right smart chance at school, I was whipped if I asked the name of the letters that spell the name of the God that made us both of one blood." Fleeing the Torches, Warren County, Kentucky, 2014. Harriet Tubman says, "I had reasoned this out in my mind. There was one of two things I had a right to, liberty or death. If I could not have one, I would have the other, for no man should take me alive. I should fight for my liberty as long as strength lasted, and when the time came for me to go, the Lord would let them take me." Hidden Passage, Mammoth Cave, Barron County, Kentucky, 2014. Documents show that passengers of the Underground Railroad passed through the city surrounding Mammoth Cave, including Cave City, Glasgow, and Mumfordville, where they could safely cross the Green River. There weren't a lot of areas that they could get across there. While there is no evidence that the cave itself was used by the Underground Railroad, the most accurate map of the system was drawn by Stephen Bishop, who was a slave and cave guide, and he gave tours in the 1840s and 1850s. When I actually contacted, it's a national park now, the National Park Service, to get access to photograph, they initially denied my request. And when I kept giving them more and more information that I was finding about the paths around the cave, they finally agreed that they just simply did not know, and that it was okay for me to come in and photograph as long as I let everybody know that I wasn't sure. So, Over the Hills, North Trimble County, Kentucky, 2014. So basically, this is literally the dividing line between the North and the South that you're looking at. You're standing in Kentucky, which is a border state. They had plantations, so part of the South. Those blue hills that you see in the background, that is actually Indiana. So you're looking at a free state. They actually called the Ohio River that separated Kentucky and Indiana and the states going east the River Jordan, and that was their goal, was to get across it. Eagle Hollow, from Hunter's Bottom, just across the Ohio River, Indiana, 2014. At Eagle Hollow, part of a network of Underground Railroad stations that shepherded slaves northward through Indiana, Chapman Harris, a free man, reverend, and blacksmith, signaled safe crossing to fugitives waiting on the Kentucky shore of the Ohio River with hammer strokes on his anvil. John H. Tibbetts, he is actually a member of the Neils Creek Anti-Slavery Society that I showed you that book at the beginning with the Constitution. His first assignment on the Underground Railroad, he later wrote a book entitled His Reminiscences, and this is an excerpt from that. After dark, I drove to the place agreed upon to meet in a piece of woods 1 mile from the town of Wirt. I had been at the appointed place but a very short time when Mr. George De Baptiste sang out, "Here is $10,000 from Hunter's Bottom tonight. A good slave at that time would fetch from $1,000 up." We loaded them in and started with the cargo of human charges towards the North Star. On the left, Nightlight passing into Fayette County, Indiana, 2014. On the right, Friend or Foe stationed just outside Metamora, Indiana, 2014. A Brief Respite, abolitionist William Beard's House, Union County, Indiana, 2014. I kept coming across in my research reference to the Henry County Female Anti-Slavery Society in Indiana. And it was actually off of my path, and so I kept ignoring it, and it kept popping up, and I kept ignoring it. So finally, I decided to pull it out and look at the original minutes book that was handwritten, like the one that I showed you earlier. And I found that members of the Henry County Female Anti-Slavery Society were taking up donations to buy 127 yards of free labor cotton in order to sew garments, vests, coats, pants, dresses, shirts, and socks. Two-thirds of the garments were directed to Salem, Union County, care of William Beard. Another interesting part about this is that I was having trouble finding the original address of William Beard's house. And this work was up on display in Santa Fe, and another woman had her work up as well in the award show. And her uncle, who was a lawyer, came to the show, and we started discussing the series and the work. And he said, "Oh, I grew up in Indiana. My ancestors are from there." Well, it turns out he was William Beard's ancestor. And so he was able to look back through his family records and send me the address so that I could go photograph the house. I had a lot of synchronistic moments like that during the series. On the left is A Safe Place to Regroup, House of Levi Coffin, who is unofficially dubbed the president of the Underground Railroad, Fountain City, formerly Newport, Indiana, 2014. Levi Coffin wrote, "The dictates of humanity came in opposition to the law of the land, and we ignored the law." On the right is Approaching the Seminary near Spartanburg, Indiana, 2014. Article 8 of the seminary, it's the Union Literary Institute Constitution, and it states, "Differences in government, discipline, and privileges will not be made with regard to color, rank, or wealth." So they were giving agricultural skills to African Americans and also teaching them how to read, and that was against the law at that time, but they did not care. On the safest route, James and Rachel Sullivan Cabin, Pennville, formerly Camden, Indiana, 2014. Several documents from the mid-1800s to the present indicate that Eliza Harris stayed at this location during her flight northward. Her crossing of the Ohio River would become one of the best-known escapes due to her representation in Harriet Beecher Stowe's 1852 novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin. Dirt Road, outside Coldwater, Michigan, 2014. Within Reach, crossing the St. Clair River to Canada, just south of Port Huron, Michigan, 2014. English writer William Cowper wrote, "Slaves cannot breathe in England and Canada. If their lungs receive our air, that moment they are free. They touch our country and their shackles fall." And the last image in this series is Freedom, Canadian Soil, Sarnia, Ontario, 2014. Harriet Tubman says, "I looked at my hands to see if I was the same person now I was free. There was such a glory over everything. The sun came like gold through the trees and over the fields, and I felt like I was in heaven." And Frederick Douglass gave a speech at Finsbury Chapel in Moorfields, England, May 12, 1846. So as he wrote and or spoke and how he wished, I hope that we can all come through the darkness into the light together. And this is what he said during that speech. Slavery is one of those monsters of darkness to whom the light of truth is death. Expose slavery and it dies. Light is to slavery what the heat of the sun is to the root of a tree. It must die under it. All the slaveholder asks of me is silence. He does not ask me to go abroad and preach in favor of slavery. He does not ask anyone to do that. He would not say that slavery is a good thing, but the best under the circumstances. The slaveholders want total darkness on the subject. They want the hatchway shut down that the monster may crawl in his den of darkness, crushing human hopes and happiness, destroying the bondman at will, and having no one to reprove or rebuke him. Slavery shrinks from the light. It hateth the light, neither cometh to the light, lest its deeds should be reproved. To tear off the mask from this abominable system, to expose it to the light of heaven, aye, to the heat of the sun, that it may burn and wither it out of existence, is my object in coming to this country. I want the slaveholder surrounded as by a wall of anti-slavery fire, so that he may see the condemnation of himself and his system glaring down in letters of light. Thank you.
This is an exploration into what compelled me to fold 1,000 origami cranes from pages of white supremacist books. When I was 67 years old, a proposal came to me from the Montana Human Rights Network asking artists to make artwork that would incorporate, respond to, or transform pages from the white man's Bible, a white supremacist book. I said I would. The box of books arrived and sat in my studio untouched for months before I could finally look at the box. What if something happened to me? A black woman living on the edge of a ghetto in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. My uncle was lynched in South Carolina before I was born. Rope around his neck, his broken body was tossed from a wagon to the yard in front of the girl who would become my mother. I looked at that box in the corner. I was born in my grandmother's house near the beginning of World War II, and in that house with grandma, I felt safe. But now I am here in my studio with an unopened box, a container of hate and fear. Can it be transformed? My grandmother said, hate hardens the heart and destroys those who carry it. This box, what am I afraid of? What do I know about fear? When I was three, my parents took me from home to live with them in their new house. Leaving grandma broke my heart. Cut, fold, crease, craft, a container to hold broken. This box, this ticking time bomb in my space, what do I know about fear? When I was five, the United States dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. How can I open this box alone? What does it mean to be singled out, to be an American rounded up in 1942, to be Jewish during the war, Japanese in 1945, or a black girl in Virginia? Hate is a fence built to signify time and place. When I was growing up, schools, churches, hospitals, libraries, and movie theaters were off limits to me because of my race. I never saw them, but I heard stories about the KKK riding through our neighborhood at night. My mom said grandma could shoot a gun straighter than a man. Cut, fold, crease, flatten, turn over, cut, fold. My friend sat with me when I pulled the box from the corner and cut it open. Out marched God's virulent white army. Lines of psychic stormtroopers pierced the page with statistics and holy proclamations. Acts of violence were justified as cleansing preparations for a brighter and whiter world. Can this be transformed? When I was 11, Paul Robeson demanded government action against lynching. His passport was revoked. I grew up with Robeson's picture pinned to my mother's bedroom wall. She said he was the only black man who spoke up against the oppression of all people. When I was 14, the U.S. ruled in Brown versus Board of Education that racially segregated schools were unconstitutional. But nothing changed where I lived. When I was 14, Emmett Till, a 14-year-old black boy, was brutally killed in Mississippi for speaking to a white woman. I will never forget the photographs of his bloated body pulled from the Tallahatchie River. Mainstream newspapers were mostly silent, but the pictures were published in all the black newspapers and magazines. We were about the same age. What do I know about white supremacy? An all-white jury acquitted two white men who boasted in public that they had killed Emmett. The conditioning to hate is very much alive in this world. Can this be transformed? Cut, crease, fold, cut, open, crease under, fold. When I was 16, Rosa Parks refused to give up her bus seat to a white passenger in Montgomery, Alabama. Where I lived, local buses crossed state lines, meaning passenger segregation could not be enforced. On that crowded bus ride home from my summer job, no one would sit next to me, a black girl dressed in her Sunday best. Soon, I became lead plaintiff in a Virginia school integration suit. I was very scared. At 18, I was a freshman at Hampton Institute. Every day I went to the library to read about what was happening. In Arkansas, the governor blocked 9 black students from entering Central High School in Little Rock. President Eisenhower ordered in 1,000 paratroopers and 10,000 National Guardsmen to enforce school desegregation plans. Mobs of angry white people spitting and screaming obscenities appeared. When I was 19, 4 black junior high school students integrated schools in Arlington. My sister, Gloria, the only girl, was 12 years old. With Little Rock fresh in my mind, I feared for her. Fold in, flip over, turn again, open, cut, fold in, flip. Can hate be transformed? At first, I tried distancing myself from the box, the books, told myself not to take it personally. The words, a knife to my throat, made me hesitate. Fold in, flip over, flatten again. We all have a relationship with hate. We single and are singled out. We ache. The soft underbelly of connection with ourselves is bruised. Anger and fear mask our discomfort and pain. I will not meet hate with hate. Am I safe? When I was 20, 4 black college freshmen went to Woolworths in Greensboro, North Carolina, and sat at the lunch counter. They were not served. When I was 23, I was one of over 200,000 people to witness Martin Luther King give "I Have a Dream" at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. I marched for Paul Robeson, Emmett, Rosa, and the domestic workers in Montgomery who walked to their jobs on aching feet rather than ride segregated buses. For Mega Evers, the World War II veteran killed after applying for entrance to university in his home state of Mississippi. for my mom, who could not make the walk. I had turned 24 when four little black girls, Addie Mae Collins, 14, Denise McNair, 11, Carol Robertson, 14, and Cynthia Wesley, 14, died one Sunday morning after four white men bombed their church in Birmingham, Alabama. What do I know about white supremacy? They wanted to kill us. 4 months later, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated on November 22nd while riding in a motorcade in Dallas, Texas. Not long after that, James Cheney, 21, Andrew Goodman, 20, and Michael Schwerner, 24, were murdered in Mississippi for registering black voters. Fold in, flip over, turn, flatten. I was 25 when unarmed protesters marching for voter rights in Selma, Alabama, were tear gassed and beaten with billy clubs by Alabama state troopers. James Reeb, a minister, was beaten to death. Finally, President Johnson called out 2,000 U.S. Army soldiers and 1,900 Alabama National Guardsmen to protect the marchers marching. One day, I met a man whose skin complexion was very dark. What I noticed was that he was unconfined by his blackness, very open, could explore the world, pursue his interests and dreams wherever they took him. I was totally astounded and curious as he spoke of being a poet in a Scandinavian country. So I asked him how he got there. He said, "It was nothing extraordinary. I was just following my path as it unfolded." As we talked, he asked, "What are your dreams?" No one had ever asked me that before. I told him, "I would like to travel abroad, go to Africa and see for myself what it was like to be there." I quickly added, "But I have a daughter and a job and bills to pay, so there's no way I can do it." Then he asked, "Why should that stand in the way?" At a loss for words, I caught a glimpse of myself following a script that had been handed to me. Was there another way? Could I, a black woman, follow my own dreams? When I was 28, an all-white jury in Meridian heard federal charges on the murders of Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner after the state of Mississippi refused to prosecute. 7 out of 18 men, including a deputy sheriff, were convicted. The Klan organizer, the man who rounded up Klansmen to intercept the three young men and arrange for a bulldozer to hide the bodies, went free, because he was a Baptist minister. What do I know about white supremacy? They wanted to kill anyone who stood with us. The box full of books, the books full of words, the words full of hate, containers we all must face. Crease, fold, flip over, turn again, open, crease, unfold. When I was 28, Martin Luther King was shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. 2 months after King was killed, Senator Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated in Los Angeles after winning the California Democratic primary. Fold, flip open. Thousands of young men were being drafted to fight in Vietnam. Anti-war protests grew and grew. My brothers looked for loopholes in continuously evolving draft regulations. In 1968, the Democratic National Convention, thousands of policemen, state and federal officers, as well as members of the Illinois National Guard, given orders to shoot to kill, were deployed to discourage and suppress anti-war protesters. Not long after I returned to the United States from Africa, 4 students at Kent State University were shot to death by Ohio National Guardsmen during an anti-Vietnam War protest. I was 30. American soldiers shot and killed unarmed white students in America's Midwest. Everyone I knew was horrified. Now, we knew that they would kill anybody. Just 10 days after the Kent State shootings, police walked on the campus of the predominantly black Jackson State College in Mississippi, stood in front of the students who were assembled, and fired 200 rounds of ammunition into the crowd. 200 rounds of ammunition. 200 rounds of ammunition. 200 rounds of ammunition. Dozens were injured. Miraculously, only two people were killed. Mainstream media headlines featured Kent State. Unarmed white American students being killed was big news. Little was reported about Jackson State College. Where was the news about the police killing blacks in Mississippi? You hardly knew it happened. Fold in, flip over, turn again, open. When I was 44, I visited the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park and Museum in Japan. Standing at that site of unbelievable suffering, I realized we all participate. Our separation makes it easy to call each other enemy, easy to be complicit in acts of violence. When I was 53, I lived near the site where a bomb exploded in the basement garage of the World Trade Center. When I was 55, a car bomb exploded outside the Federal Office Building in Oklahoma City. Open, unfold, flip over, open, unfold. When I was 58, James Byrd, a 49-year-old black man, died while being dragged by three white men for 3 miles on an asphalt road behind their pickup truck in Jasper, Texas. 4 months later, Matthew Shepard, a 21-year-old gay Wyoming student, was fatally beaten in what was ruled a hate crime related to sexual orientation. So much killing. So much anger, so much fear. Can hate be transformed? I was 62 and at home in New York City the morning that three jetliners rammed into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11, 2001. A fourth hijacked plane crashed 80 miles outside of Pittsburgh. I have no words to describe what being there was like that day. It shook all of us out of our complacency, our separateness. On that day in New York City, differences were not barriers. They had been an illusion within myself. I did not want another war, but it was not in my hands. Violence has never stopped violence. At 67, I remember the Japanese legend that anyone who folds 1,000 paper cranes so pleases the gods that they will be granted one wish. Can we find a way to live our lives without killing each other? When I was 75, a young white man killed 9 black people at a church prayer service in Charleston, South Carolina. Despite a lifetime of living under the shadow of killings and murders, this man's actions were even hard for me to believe. I was deeply moved when families of the people who were killed forgave the shooter right away. Their act became a gift of compassion, love, and forgiveness for all of us. In the absence of a wall of hate and anger to push against, the conversation opened up. South Carolina legislators voted. The Confederate flag was removed from the flagpole in front of their state house within 3 weeks after the shooting. I watched a live online feed of the flag being removed by South Carolina state troopers. I thought of my mother's brothers, my mother's brother who had been lynched in South Carolina before I was born. I felt her looking through my eyes. Cut, fold, crease, unfold, cut, crease, fold, open. It takes 52 steps to fold one simple origami crane. How many steps will it take to open our hearts? Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.